This is On Target with Penny Wolfgang, a program that takes an inside look at what is happening in Western New York with news, features, and special guests. Now, here's your host, Penny Wolfgang.
Hi, everybody, and thank you so much for joining us today. I am your host on Target, Penny Wolfgang, and we are here every week, and we like to talk about subjects that we think are interesting and important and topical and educational for all of us who live here in the Western New York community, and we hope you listen to us every week so you know the variety of subjects and guests that we have covering all kinds of things, health, education, crime in the streets, the law, of course. Sometimes we do talk about that, which, as you can imagine, is that and the theater are my two favorite subjects. But you probably know that if you listen a lot. Well, anyway, and we also tried to talk about community events and community activities. But as far as the law goes, I was really excited recently to see a brochure or a handout in court in the 8th Judicial District, and they said that they were going to have a speaker talking about the subject of domestic violence in sports. And I thought, this is not only topical, but interesting across around so many levels. We've heard so much about it. And it turns out that this is only one part of what's going on at the law school and in our educational system in general. I just learned from our guest, Professor Helen Nellie Drew, who is at the University of Buffalo Law School, School of Law, I guess you should say, that not only is the issue of domestic violence in sports and sports law a course that they teach in the law school, but it's involved, it's kind of, what do you call it, intra-jurisdictional, no, what do they call it,
cross-disciplinary.
Cross-disciplinary. It wasn't even close, was I? But I'm not you know, education person, so I didn't know what they call it. But there are courses related to this in the medical school and in the education department.
Well, it's a center, but to be a little more specific, we have just opened the Center for the Advancement of Sport at UB, and that is the Center for the Advancement of Sport at UB.
Okay.
And it is a cross-disciplinary venture among the School of Medicine, School of Law, School of Public Health. It's housed in the law school, the athletic department, School of Education, School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. And what it is an opportunity to harness and all of the various wonderful research and programming we already have in place in the sports industry and focus that more specifically on those topics in sports which are relevant and important and not only great experiential learning for our students, but also employment opportunities in the future as well.
And so current and topical that it's like learning and reading a newspaper or the news or the media in your classes, because it's something that's going on, as you pointed out to me. Sadly, almost every day there's some kind of an event related to that.
That's so true. And in fact, I literally threw out my textbook about 3 or 4 years ago because it printed material simply could not keep up. And in fact, that was about the same time we saw the saga of Ray Rice and the NFL's very, very significant struggles with dealing with domestic violence issues among players.
Now, can you give us a little background? Why or is this something that would be involved, domestic violence and sports, together?
Well, I think sports are a microcosm society, right? So it's a problem that we see throughout our community. And sports being as high profile as it is, what happens is that there's additional attention paid, certainly a lot more media attention paid when something goes out across social media involving a professional athlete.
And of which there have been many.
Yes.
But is there something related to the nature of playing sports or being an athlete that you think is coordinated or is correlated or responds to violence?
That's a great question. I haven't seen research that bears that out. Certainly there are people that think that. There's also the questions to whether or not in certain sports, the element of additional contact and the potential for CTE, which we know is related to frontal lobe damage and problems with impulse control and the like may also be related, but that research doesn't exist yet.
I guess it's just a common sense thing that ordinary people would think, right? You just think, okay, sports, violence. Well, we saw the game the other day, and the football game ended up sort of like with some kind of a brawl during the course of it. That was violence that you usually see in hockey and everyone hockey games. And everyone was saying, is this football or is this hockey? So it kind of is in people's mind that there's got to be violence involved.
I have to hesitate here a bit because I don't want to make it seem as if it isn't as prevalent in the community as a whole. I think the important part about it happening in sports and the league's attempts to grapple with it is that it does bring our attention to a very real problem that many in our community have to deal with on a daily basis, and that's something I don't want to not place enough emphasis upon.
Well, what do you teach in the course?
The course mm-hmm. I don't teach domestic violence per se. I teach about domestic violence as part of my Sports Law 1 course, and certainly anytime an incident arises, this past weekend there was an incident involving a San Francisco 49ers player who was arrested for the second time for a domestic violence incident, and we'll talk about these matters that occur in current events because they are very real employment issues that the employer has to deal with, the team, and certainly the league does as well, but they also have ramifications for the people involved, and we talk about those as well. So even if you never, practice as a sports attorney, at some point in your career, you may very well encounter a person who has a problem or an issue involving domestic violence that needs to be addressed.
Now, what does a sports attorney do, per se?
Oh, a variety of different things. There's so many different job opportunities. You might decide to go into the compliance field. You might decide, most students think they want to be a player agent. They've seen the movie Jerry Maguire, mm-hmm. Show Me the Money.
Me too, me too.
I have enough children. I have 7. I don't need another child, so I've never wanted to go that route. My 7 are lovely, thank you. I don't need another one. The league counsel, perhaps. You might be counsel to a university. You might work in a sports-related field, and there are many, many opportunities in those areas as well. Everything from New Era is something you'll think about locally, Delaware North. Certainly, there are so many, many, many different opportunities to be engaged in that area.
What do you have to learn or know? Is it mostly contract negotiations, for example? That's really what Jerry Maguire did.
That
wasn't
could
it?
Very
I mean,
well,
seriously.
It was. And counseling, career counseling. If you are going to be a player agent, yes, that's a large part of it. Arbitration, that type of thing. Depending upon the role that you assume, it could be a variety of different things. Over the course of my career, so I worked for Cohen Suedos. I worked for Bob Suedos. And I worked primarily on Sabres and NHL accounts. And we covered, he had me doing everything and anything from Alexander McGillney's defection to Pat LaFontaine and Dominic Hasek's contracts to building the new arena. So you can do a variety of different things, and the best part about it is you never get bored, you never get tired, because there's always something new every day.
Bob Suedos was so well known and so famous, and he wrote a book.
He did.
And he was a guest on Target all those many years ago.
Was he really?
Yes. And he was talking about, representing the Sabres and all that he had to do, and it was fascinating. Fascinating, and it made, I'm sure, all my listeners wish that they were doing that.
He was a wonderful, wonderful mentor, yeah. and a very good friend, and I cannot thank him enough for all he did for me.
So let me go back to the law and what you're doing, or what one is doing, is representing either the player or the company, actually, right? You could
sure.
be on either side,
or the league,
or the union. Or the league, right. Now, is a lot of it have to do, when we mentioned, for example, domestic violence, does a lot of it have to do with what the league can or should do as far as, I don't know if regulating is the right word, but dealing yeah. with players and what they, any misfortunes that they run across, any misadventures that they have, any problems?
Yeah, certainly, in any employment situation, you're going to be concerned when you have an employee who may or may not be acting in a way that reflects well upon your business. The sports leagues have taken individual approaches. The NFL has probably received the most publicity because they have what's called a personal conduct policy, which applies to not just the players, but anyone affiliated with the NFL. That means the owners, that means coaches, executives, as well as the players. And you are expected to live up to a standard of conduct that's above and beyond what is legal, but is also considered to be appropriate and good for the game as well.
And is this put in contract form, in written form, and when they sign, when the player signs up, for example, or is signed up?
So the personal conduct policy is not actually part of the player's contract, and actually to date in the NFL, it has not been officially adopted as part of the collective bargaining agreement. However, it is a document that the commissioner has issued. Originally, it was put together in conjunction with the NFLPA, and it governs everyone involved with the league.
Let me go back to, in case you just tuned in, you are listening to On Target with your host, Penny Wolfgang. And today we are talking to Professor Helen Nelly Drew at the University at Buffalo School of Law. And she is an expert in what is known as sports law. And we're kind of, you know, talking about the different areas that covers. And one that we haven't gotten to, which I think people are very aware of, is Title IX.
Yes.
Because I want to say it's new, but obviously it's not new. But it's something that, like, in our lifetime, it
yes.
came about.
Yes. In my lifetime, it was something that was coming about in the schools. I remember when I was in high school, I'm dating myself here, they weren't quite sure what to do in my high school when Title IX passed. So they thought, what is the one sport that we can have the girls and the boys play together? Everybody thought it meant having co-ed gym. What's the one sport that the girls and the boys can play together? No one will get upset. And it was volleyball. So we played a lot of volleyball. We had a lot of fun. We had played a lot of volleyball. But over time, Title IX has evolved. It took a very long time for it to become even somewhat effective, but over time it has resulted in many more opportunities for young girls and women to play sports, which is fantastic. But it has a lot of challenges, shall we say, in implementation.
Such as, I mean, I often wondered what it means to the average person.
So ideally, it's supposed to mean that women and men have equal opportunities in athletics and education generally. The word athletics does not appear anywhere in Title IX. It's educational opportunities. Yes, isn't that interesting?
That's interesting, right?
Yes,
because everyone
is.
Just puts it together in their mind with athletics. You know?
Yes, and that's been the primary impact. But the opportunities are supposed to be equal. The challenge, of course, is that the revenue that's generated by certain men's sports tends to be overwhelming. And so if you did it simply on a revenue-based system, that would not be equal. Similarly, we don't have unlimited resources, so resources have to be allocated. And there are always difficulties in ensuring that women's and men's programs receive, you know, similar resources relative to, you know, participation and to student engagement. And over time, we've also seen it's become something of a political football. So over the course of various presidential administrations, there have been efforts to roll back Title IX. Currently, right now, Title IX of the Obama administration was considered to protect transgender individuals. And right now, we have an administration that's attempting to redefine transgender out of existence, which is difficult, certainly, for athletic departments and other entities that are trying to comply with Title IX.
Well, doesn't a lot of the inequality have to do with it's monetary? That's what we pointed out already.
Sure.
But isn't it because of the almighty dollar, in the sense that the media, the television rights, which are what sustains, you know, football, all of the big basketball, all the big major sports, everything. They don't have the viewership, allegedly, for women's sports as much as men's, and that's why they don't put the money into it, and that's why they don't give them the money, and that's why they don't get on television.
That's contracts
and rights.
Sure.
I'm going around on this, you know, trying.
Well, there's a certain aspect of course.
Which came first, the chicken or the egg? But you know,
right. But having said that, you know, the successful football and basketball programs also tend to fund those, you know, smaller programs, both men's and women's, that wouldn't otherwise be able to exist. You know, so sure, if you have a successful football team where you have, you know, in excess of 50 players in the roster, but you're also providing, by virtue of that football team's revenue sources, you know, a fencing team for the women and a tennis team and a gymnastics team that might not otherwise exist, there's a balancing that goes on there.
Yeah, so that has, but it does have to do with, all of it has to do with revenue. A lot of it, 1,000% of it has to do with revenue.
And where you put it, yes.
Yeah, I don't know how else you can say it, right? When we are talking about sports law, and we were kind of referred a little bit to the matter of the discipline of professional athletes. And you said that the code, the morals code and so forth, is not something that's in their contract, but it's in the the NFL, for example, has it. Is it a policy?
It's a policy.
Policy.
Right.
Yeah.
So is a morals clause in each of the standard player contracts for each of the leagues, and essentially that will allow a contract to be terminated if a player does something that breaches that clause. So, for example, after the 49ers incident I referred to this weekend, that player was cut from the team. But the NFL personal conduct policy is something that stands alone, that was instituted by the league after a series of events, I think it was about 2005, excuse me, when there was a series of really, really bad situations that reflected very poorly on the NFL.
Do we have to go all the way back to O.J.?
As the question.
Don't you think?
Well, I'm old enough to remember what he looked like and sounded like and acted like when he played here in Buffalo, and it doesn't bear any resemblance to that now.
But I mean, I think a lot of the laws and regulations and rules and morals clauses and a lot of things changed in the league and everywhere else because of. Actually, television in the courtroom, everything
yes,
changed.
Yes,
that definitely had an effect on the leagues and on sports.
Well, certainly, it's not it's not the best look for any league to have one of its elder statesmen in court for a criminal trial for murder like that. Absolutely.
Well, we started out, and I didn't want to leave it all together alone to the issue of domestic violence in sports. Is this we already talked about whether it could be because they're trained to be violent in their for their jobs, for their sports? But on the other hand, don't people always say, experts always say, that domestic violence is a matter of control, trying to control? I mean, we've done a lot of programs on domestic violence in general, and it's not really a matter of force. It's a matter of psychological control over the other person.
Certainly, that's a compelling element of it. And some leagues have taken this as a way to get players into counseling. So, for example, Major League Baseball and the NBA also have very definitive mental health programs that they expect players to participate in if they are determined to have been involved in this type of behavior.
Now we're up to mental health, so it leads right into one of the most, I think, current subjects relating to any kind of sports, and that's the issue of concussions.
Yes. Yeah, that's a fascinating topic, and that's something that all sports continue to wrestle with, not just the contact sports, the traditional contact sports, if you will. The research that's being done here at UB by Dr. John Letty has been revolutionary, and it's something, again, that the research has continued to be prepared, and the leagues are reacting oftentimes more slow than we like to see, and perhaps sometimes the law isn't as effective as we would like it to be. So you might have seen the NHL concussion settlement was just reached recently, and because of a variety of things, including issues with causation, the NHL players involved in that suit did not receive much in terms of a settlement.
Well, you have to explain a little more about that because, our listeners may not be as aware as we are of when you say the issue of quote-unquote causation.
Sure. So there's fairly significant research that documents, and for people who may have seen the movie or the book, League of Denial, or involving the NFL, there's a fairly high-profile situation involving several NFL players that was documented in that fashion. But in the course in a football game, you have contact on virtually every play. So while a class of prospective plaintiffs, football players, might be somewhat more likely to be able to demonstrate that they had received concussive or repeated subconcussive forces to their heads that might have resulted in some sort of trauma and something like CTE, although we have not yet been able to identify a test for that that's available if someone's still alive, or Lou Gehrig's disease, or similar types of issues, Parkinson's, for example. In the hockey scenario, there is not necessarily contact in every play. And again, that makes it that much
more difficult. It's not
supposed to be. Well, depending on which league you're in.
Well, in any case, but either way, as you were saying about the concussion, about the contact, the causation is very difficult to prove, as you're trying to say, what may have caused, what the relationship may have been between what happened when they were playing whatever the sport may be and the end result of,
Sure, and people may be predisposed. We don't know why some people get and some people don't. There may be genetic factors involved. There might be substance abuse involved. It may have happened when someone was in high school as opposed to when they're playing professionally. There's no way of sorting that out, at least at this point.
So then when they say there's so-and-so was injured or hit during the, I'll use football, the game, and so he is in a quote-unquote concussion protocol. What are they talking about?
I mean, someone's been removed from the game because there's the potential that they may have received a concussive hit, and they are then, depending upon the sport you're talking about, removed by an independent person who will evaluate them, put them through a series of exercises to determine if, in fact, they have sustained a concussion, and if they have, to the extent to which they have received that type of injury, what type of recovery and rehabilitation is appropriate. But generally speaking, that means that person will be held out of the action for a period of time.
And this is a set protocol and a set period of time and predetermined tests that they're now doing?
Yes, and each league has something of a somewhat of a different approach, but they are all based upon verifiable medical information and evaluation.
And what about kids? And I mean, now everyone is like, would you let your kid play, if you have a son, would you let him play football? If you had a son, would you let him play? I don't know why it always seems to be, well, girls don't really play football.
So some girls do. And I'm told there's a girl quarterback out there in high school who's probably very, very good. But I will tell you that my daughters all played ice hockey. Some still do.
Yeah, hockey definitely.
Yes. As a parent now, I'd have a real hard time with football.
Because
we don't know.
You don't know. And because also, as you mentioned, causation, but there's, as you said, so many other factors that everything now is undetermined and undecided, and you don't know the answer, whether it's from this or from that or from something else unrelated.
Right. So for an excess of caution, yes, I would say I probably have a hard time with it.
We're talking to Professor Helen Nellie Drew at the University at Buffalo School of Law, who is an expert in sports law, which is what we are talking about. Now, there's one other thing we mentioned, which everyone is always curious about. When they talk about franchises, and they talk about this person has a contract with the franchise, and they're a free agent, or they're not a free agent, or the league has X amount of dollars. Who determines to spend? Who determines all that?
How much money they have available?
How is it determined?
So, depending upon the league, each of the leagues has certain structures in place. For example, like a salary cap is probably what you're referring to.
That's what I was getting at.
Okay, so that's determined under the collective bargaining agreement, which is negotiated between the players and the union. And it varies depending upon the league. But the objective is to try to even the playing field as much as possible so that owners with unlimited resources can't essentially buy a championship.
So let's say I'm a Yankee fan, let's say, because I grew up in New York, and not only my father, my grandfather, and every single person in my family. How come with all the money that they have to spend, they can't get a winning team? Could you explain that?
If I could, I'd be making a lot more money, is all I can tell you.
No, seriously, not that question, but seriously, is people do say that, well, you can buy, if you have unlimited resources, you can buy all the best players, and that is being prevented by these various...
Depending upon the league. Some leagues have more stringent restrictions upon them than others. Major League Baseball's restrictions are not as stringent as the NFL's, for example. So it just depends. And of course, there is that intuitive aspect, too, that you can't buy, right? There are some people who just bring that winning component with them.
Unfortunately, you can't tell, right?
When
you're doing it now on the salary cap issue, when you're teaching like professional sports, or you're teaching sports in general, and you talk about professional sports and salary caps and all that, how do you learn that? How does one learn that as an attorney?
How did I learn it? That's what it's taught me.
Yeah. How do your students learn it? What do they do to learn?
So one of the courses I teach actually is a mock salary arbitration course. Mm-hmm. So we do it with the NHL because the statistics are relatively easily identifiable in a short period of time. I do it in the January term. So each student represents either a player or a club. And they have to negotiate that person and their relationship with the club and what their value is in the open market. And they negotiate against their partner, and then they have to arbitrate against their partner.
This sounds like a lot of fun.
It's a great time.
Does this sound like a serious law school course?
Well, you learn a lot about arbitration, which you can do in a variety of settings.
That's true.
They practice their negotiation skills. They have to write a brief and get up on their feet. So
it is, huh? I told you before we went in the air that when I was in law school, this is really sad. I mean, it was like the ancient days, I guess, when we had all subjects like really boring, like property law.
Well, we still teach those.
Con law and all that, constitutional law and property, and torts, which are not apple torts and cherry torts, they're, you know, injuries. So it wasn't fun at all. So I'm really jealous of these young students now that they can learn professional sports and they can learn about sports negotiation and women's rights, which is also courses that I know there's a lot of, and practice, which is really important. So thank you so much. It was really good talking to you.
We've been talking
to Professor Helen Nelly Drew at the University at Buffalo School of Law about sports law. We hope you've enjoyed our conversation. Please join us again next week for On Target. Have a good week, and thank you for listening, everybody.
You've been listening to On Target with Penny Wolfgang, a program that takes an inside look at Western New York and our community. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write to Penny Wolfgang at 500 Corporate Parkway, Suite 200, Amherst, New York, 14226.